Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. We'll talk about the progress toward a coronavirus vaccine now. A lot of vaccine science, but also some vaccine politics, vaccine equity, and vaccine economics. On the politics, the New York Times has a story today that opens with a Health and Human Services Department presentation to the White House back in April that included the words, deadline, enable broad access to the public by October 2020. That, of course, would be very convenient for the home stretch of President Trump's reelection campaign, even if a vaccine isn't proven safe yet. They call it Operation Warp Speed. But what besides speed could such a process warp? But on the science, Dr. Anthony Fauci, who presumably wouldn't play games with vaccine safety, also told a congressional hearing last week that fast, at least pretty fast, could be safe and realistic.
I know to some people this seems like it is so fast that there might be compromising of safety and in scientific integrity, and I can tell you that is absolutely not the case. The rapidity with which we're doing it is as a result of very different technologies in getting from the time we recognized this pathogen in the beginning of January to the time we were able to get into a phase one trial, to the time we were able to do phase two, and then, as I mentioned, just this past Monday, we started a phase three. That was not reckless rushing. That was technology and doing things in a way that does not compromise any of the steps.
Dr. Fauci testifying before Congress last week. So let's start there and talk about the progress toward a vaccine and what it would actually mean to have a vaccine with Caroline Chen, who covers healthcare for ProPublica. Hi, Caroline. Thanks for doing this with us. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, good morning.
So you heard the optimism there from Dr. Fauci. I know you also spoke to scientists for your reporting and heard a lot of optimism. We're starting to hear about several specific but different vaccine research efforts going on now, one from Moderna, one from Pfizer, one at Oxford University, also China and Russia, both accused of trying to steal Western research, but those are also additional efforts in their own rights, apparently. Is it clear which is the furthest along or how different these research trials are from each other?
Yeah, so at this point, there are a few of these vaccine candidates that are in phase three trials, which is the final stage of clinical trials. So this includes, if we look globally, this includes the Moderna trial, the Pfizer, those are both what we call mRNA vaccines. Then there is the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine that is a different technology. That's a viral vector vaccine. That's also in phase three trials outside of the U.S. And then there are also other vaccine protein-based vaccines and a number of, you know, what they call whole virus vaccines, which are what you typically think of, I think what they teach you in like middle school, high school science, where you take, the virus and you weaken it. Those are also being developed mainly by companies in China. And I think this is actually a good thing that there are so many different technologies and modalities being tried, because we want to make sure that we have a vaccine ultimately that works. Mm-hmm. And if we were all to use the exact same technology, I think that, you know, limits our chance of success. So it is a good thing that there are many different technologies being tried.
And because I know our listeners to the Brian Lehrer Show are not afraid of a little science, why don't you take us into one of those research methodologies? Because you wrote about one way of producing immunity that you said many manufacturers are trying, involving what they call a spike protein. Can you describe the science of spike proteins in brief?
Yeah, sure. And actually, many of the modalities I just talked to you about involve the spike protein. And then I can, so let me explain what that is, and then maybe I can dive into the mRNA vaccine, which is the Moderna vaccine, which is probably what most of your listeners have heard about the most, the Moderna and Pfizer. So the spike protein, very easy for me to explain what it is. I'm sure everybody has seen pictures of the coronavirus by now, and the spike protein is just a little bit that sticks out on the virus. So if you imagine it as a ball, and there are all these little bits sticking out like little spikes, the spike protein. And the reason why it's so interesting to vaccine manufacturers is that that's the part that engages with the human cell that it's trying to get into. So it's kind of like the part that like plugs into the human cell. So since that's the first point of contact, if your body recognizes the spike protein, which is unique to the coronavirus, then it should recognize the whole coronavirus. So that's why manufacturers are so interested in that part. Now, an mRNA vaccine, so this is Moderna's vaccine, this is Pfizer's vaccine, and a number of other manufacturers, are able to get to the front of the line because they are not even making the spike protein. They are just giving you a little piece of genetic code. So I'm sure you've heard of DNA and RNA. So mRNA is a genetic code-based vaccine. So they give you a little piece of instruction, which is made up of genetic code. They kind of fold it into a vaccine, and then they just inject that into your arm, and your own cells kind of read the instruction. It's kind of like a recipe, and your cells, which know how to make proteins all day long, that's what they do, they make the spike protein themselves, and then they present it to your immune system, and your immune system learns, oh, this is what a spike protein looks like. So when they then encounter it in the wild attached to a real coronavirus, in theory, it should be able to then recognize it and block it.
That's such a great, concise explanation of those two different methods. May the best vaccine win. And listeners, if you have a coronavirus vaccine question for Caroline Chen, health reporter for ProPublica, we can take it at 646-435-7280, or you can tweet us at Brian Lehrer. But on the phones at 646-435-7280 with your coronavirus vaccine questions, 646-435-7280. Here's another clip of Dr. Fauci from his congressional testimony in which he says he's not actually worried about China trying to hack into American vaccine research, which has been much in the news.
I think one of the things people need to understand that what we do is really transparent. We publish it, we announce it. So if they want to hack into a computer and find out what the results of a vaccine trial are, they're going to hear about it in the New England Journal of Medicine in a few days anyway.
So Caroline, do you know more about how that actually all works? Like, I wonder, considering the global importance of this, why isn't all the research just open source anyway, everyone sharing with everyone every step of the way?
Yeah, I think to a large degree what Dr. Fauci said was right in that, you know, ultimately the results of a trial are going to be published in journals for everyone to see. So there's not going to be a big secret there. You know, the specific manufacturing processes of, you know, a specific vaccine, you know, the way Pfizer makes its mRNA vaccine versus the way Moderna makes its mRNA vaccine, you know, down to the specific detail of every manufacturing step, they may not publish that. However, I think, you know, at the end of the day, even if these things were published, then that doesn't get us all the way to the finish line, because the thing that we need to remember is that even knowing how to make it does not mean that you can make it perfectly consistently, so it is exactly the same every time. And this is what we need to be able to mass manufacture for the public. Like, this is what the FDA needs to ensure, that it is exactly the same in terms of safety, quality, efficacious every time when it comes off the manufacturing lot. So, you know, even if the recipe was out there, you're still many steps from being able to get to a mass marketable, reliable product.
We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, I'm going to ask if the vaccines that they're developing against coronavirus will be more like your tetanus shot or more like the annual flu vaccine, and why that matters to a very large degree to how much it will protect us. So as we continue with Caroline Chen from ProPublica on coronavirus vaccines, our lines are also open at 646-435-7280, and we'll take your calls as well. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.
You don't have to be wealthy or retiring to take advantage of tax-smart charitable planning. Whatever your stage of life or income level, planning now can help protect your assets and create a legacy that secures WNYC's future as an independent service to our community. Learn more about WNYC's Listener's Legacy Circle. Send an email to legacygiving@wnyc.org or call 646-829-4587.
Support for WNYC comes from Mohonk Mountain House, presenting Garden Holiday, August 31st through September 4th, featuring garden tours, nature walks, workshops, flower arranging, and demonstrations with horticulturalists. Mohonk.com. The New York Botanical Garden, now open with 250 acres and 1 million plants to explore. For visitor safety, timed entry reservations required. More at nybg.org. WNYC thanks our sponsors in the business community for supporting us at this historic time as we continue our work delivering breaking news, critical information, and context to our community and the nation. Your support matters more than ever. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Caroline Chen, health reporter for ProPublica, looking into vaccine research. And Maggie in Morris County, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. How you doing?
I'm good. I basically have a question about coronavirus vaccine efficacy. Basically, when it comes to the common cold, it adapts so much and the nature of that kind of virus is that you can't really make a vaccine for it. So how effective would a coronavirus vaccine be?
Great question. Caroline?
I love that you're asking this question because it's such an important one. And so just to give a little bit of context here, we all kind of instinctively know that there's some vaccines, say like the measles vaccine, where if you do as recommended and you get your two doses, it's very, very effective. It's like 97% plus effective at preventing you from ever getting infected at all. So that's close to what they call sterilizing immunity. And then you have the flu shot, which varies a lot year to year in terms of its effectiveness. And so I asked a lot of experts, what do we expect? So the first thing I have to say is that we don't know until we know. We have to run the phase 3 trial. We have to get the data back. A lot of people pointed out to me that the flu, the seasonal flu, is really in a class of its own because it does mutate a lot year to year. And that's why we need a new flu shot every year. And scientists are basically guessing every year based on the data that they gather, you know, from the Southern Hemisphere, what they're going to produce for the next year. And that's why it varies a lot year to year. The coronavirus, this coronavirus, is not mutating anywhere near that fast as far as scientists can see. And so that gives them hope that it's going to be more effective than the seasonal flu shot. That's the hope. As I said, we're going to have to see the actual data. However, there are kind of two definitions of effective when vaccine manufacturers talk about this. One is preventing people from getting sick, so like preventing hospitalizations, preventing severe illness. The other is preventing people from getting infected at all. And both of these things are going to be measured in the phase 3 trials. And I think we're going to just have to see what comes out in the data. I don't think anybody has a crystal ball. And what I am most concerned with is that whatever gets approved by the FDA, and honestly, I expect there to be more than one vaccine approved, is that the efficacy gets really clearly communicated to the public.
That's so interesting that there could be two different vaccines and individuals would have to choose which one to get. Why would there be two? If one is clearly more effective than the other, then it would become the dominant and the sole, wouldn't it?
Yeah. So you're right. So I think eventually it would become the dominant, but I think right now, because we're in a pandemic and there's a crisis, any manufacturer probably cannot on their own immediately make enough vaccine for the entire globe overnight. So the expectation is even, you know, best case scenario, everything lines up, you know, we get good data, good enough for approval, at least. Again, it may probably will not be 100% effective, but good enough to approve before the end of this year. Any manufacturer will probably only have, you know, on the order of single digit million doses. So that's not going to be enough for the whole of the U.S., let alone the entirety of the globe. So if there's a second manufacturer, you know, just a couple months behind, who mm-hmm. also has, you know, a few million doses available on hand, you know, the government's not going to turn that down. Now, you're right that eventually, you know, and we're talking here probably over the scale of years really, the whichever is the best vaccine will probably be able to capture the whole market. But I think in the initial months, it is possible that we'll have more than one approved, especially across the globe. You know, in China, in Europe, in the U.S., I would not be surprised if that's the case. We haven't even talked about the fact that some of them require cold shipping, cold storage, and you have to think about, you know, some countries across the world might be better suited to certain types of shipping and storage handling. So there are just so many factors that go into vaccine manufacturing and handling that are at play here as all these manufacturers get into this production.
Do you think they'll have a vaccine ready for public use to announce by October before Election Day, as the president wants?
I hate predicting the future because that means I can be wrong. But I, you know, in the best case scenario, given that Moderna has already started a phase 3 trial, we haven't talked about how phase 3 trials run here. I do want to just say to your listeners that they aren't put on a schedule. It's not like I start in July, therefore that means I can pin a date on the calendar and that's when I'll have results. It depends on the infection rate. But it is possible that Moderna will have data that is viewable by the FDA by late fall. And so if the data is, you know, fantastic, it's clear, it's a home run, yes, there could be some vaccine available. But again, it's not going to be, you know, one golden day where we have enough vaccine for the entirety of the U.S. or the entirety of the globe. There will be potentially some vaccine available for some of the public. And then there's going to be this question of how do we prioritize? How do we distribute? Who gets the vaccine first? And then my concern will be that there is access for the people that need it most.
Rob in Texas, you're on WNYC with Caroline Chen from ProPublica. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Caroline. I had a question. My understanding about Operation Warp Speed is that the government has already bought 300 million doses of the vaccine. Do we have any idea of how they're going to distribute that, if people who are uninsured will be able to get the virus at no or low cost? Or if there's any historical precedent for the government doing something like this before?
We'll be able to get the vaccine, yeah.
So, sorry, you were a little bit muffled, but my understanding is about distribution and being able to get this at low cost. So there are, unfortunately, not a ton of details yet about the distribution plan for the vaccine. But you're right, it is going to be really important that there's no barrier to access based on your insurance status, your ability to pay. And, you know, everything that you just said needs to happen. I have not personally yet seen a laid out plan for how this is going to go down. I know that there are people who are thinking about this and hopefully working on this, but I think a lot of the manufacturers have indicated that they're not going to, you know, make cost a barrier. They know that that would be not a good move. in terms of exactly to what degree the government is going to be paying, I don't think those details have been made clear to the public yet.
Well, I guess it comes back to the question of these companies competing with each other to develop a vaccine first. Is there a public health advantage or disadvantage to the profit motive being in play here for the pharmaceutical companies? Or maybe that's something you haven't looked into yet.
No, and I think traditionally part of the reason why vaccine manufacturing has not been a big draw for manufacturers is because there isn't as big of a profit motive, because it has to be something that is priced really low for the public to receive it broadly. You know, you can't, you just can't charge as much for a vaccine as you can for a cancer drug. That's the fact of the matter. So this is a very different situation, of course, where manufacturers all want to be in the game, because there is obviously such a big public need for it. And there is a lot of government dollars, philanthropy dollars coming into the space. So we're in a very atypical kind of environment for manufacturers compared to the norm.
Bill in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Good afternoon. Good morning, rather, Brian and Carol. I have a question relating to the way in which the vaccines, any of them, are grown. Do we happen to know, are any of these vaccines cultured in chicken embryo? Because I, for one, have a violent allergy to chicken, and most of the vaccines, the flu vaccines generally, are cultured in chicken embryo, which would cause an anaphylactic reaction, possibly death to anybody who took that.
Yeah, and that's so one of the questions they ask you before you take a flu shot is, are you allergic to chicken eggs, something like that? So very few people are, but Bill is, so he's one of those people who shouldn't get a flu shot, it sounds like. So do you know if they're cultured in any similar way, the ones that are being developed?
So unfortunately, I do not know for certain off the top of my head the answer to your question. I can't tell you which manufacturers is cultured that way. But I think, again, this is why it is important to have many different modalities. My suspicion is that the nucleic acid vaccine, so the mRNA vaccines, would not involve any sort of culturing, and because they're made out of genetic material and would not involve that process. I could be wrong, but again, this is why having different modalities is useful, because there may be the need to have mm-hmm. different options for different right. people depending on their allergies.
Interesting.
But feel free to send me an email on that, and I can look a little further for you.
Bonnie in Suffolk County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, how are you? I'm just really concerned about compliance. We have a lot of anti-vaxxers out here on Long Island. And, you know, I know, like, kids can't go to school if they're not vaccinated for their, you know, usual vaccines. But what about this new coronavirus vaccine? What about adults? I know my hairdresser, last time I got my hair cut before, or, like, right before the pandemic, she was like, I'm not getting a vaccine if they come up with it. I don't trust it. Huh. So how are they going to, like, market this to show people that it's safe? How are they going to ensure compliance? Like, I'm just really concerned about that. Like, if the herd immunity is not there, it's not going to be as effective. And I'm really concerned about making sure people get it.
I'm concerned right with you, frankly. And I think this is part of the reason why I keep thinking that we both need to get this right and we need to not get it wrong. I know that sounds like I'm saying the exact same thing here, but what I'm trying to say is that we need a coronavirus vaccine, and we need to get it right, because we do want to stop transmission. We want to stop this pandemic. But I think that there are many steps ahead, you know, as I mentioned, manufacturing, distribution, that go beyond just getting the science right and having an approved vaccine, where I think that if any of those steps go wrong in a major way, you know, you go back to the distribution of the polio vaccine and the Qatar incident there, that had nothing to do with the science of the vaccine. That was a manufacturing flaw. I think that will really fuel anti-vax sentiment if there's a major mistake like that. And that would actually do a lot of harm to other vaccination programs, let alone the coronavirus vaccine. So that's my concern. And I do think that this is going to have to be a major public health communications effort, and that goes from federal to state to county, local, you know, involves family doctors. And I frankly think that this should be starting now. I think we get a practice run with this year's flu shot. It's going to be really important that people get their flu shot this year because we don't want hospitals to be overwhelmed this fall with flu patients when we want those beds potentially for COVID patients. You know, so we kind of get a practice run with our communication, and we'll have to see how it goes.
And your answer to our caller, Maggie from Morris County, really answered the question that I had teased before the break. How would the vaccine for coronavirus be more like your tetanus shot or more like the flu vaccine, and why does that have so much importance? Because this weekend I looked up the relative effectiveness in different of different vaccines, and I saw, as you've also said in that answer, the polio vaccine 99 to 100% effective, the tetanus shot 100% effective, measles 93% after one shot, 97% after two, so almost 100%. But the flu vaccine that many of us get every fall, according to Pharmacy Times, flu vaccine effectiveness for the 2018-2019 flu season was estimated to be 61% in children under 18, but just 24% effective for adults 50 years and older. And you answered most of that by saying the flu virus mutates from year to year and even sometimes within a flu season, and so far they're not seeing that with COVID-19. I guess my one remaining question on that is, why would it be so different for children and adults, if you know?
I do think that with children and adults, again, this is, you know, how robust the immune system is. When you talk about like little children or very elderly adults, sometimes their immune system is not as strong. So the question is, can you provoke a strong enough immune system reaction that they can learn what you're trying to teach them with the vaccine? So sometimes the effectiveness of the vaccine can vary depending on the age of who you're giving it to. Now, I think what is really good and important is that in the phase three trials right now for the coronavirus vaccine, they are specifically making sure to include elderly study participants because we know that COVID is very dangerous for elderly. So we want to make sure that this vaccine works in that population. So they are making sure that the study includes people over the age of 55, and they're going to make sure to track the results in that age category because there's no point in putting out a vaccine that doesn't work for the elderly, right?
Yeah.
So that's really important. One other thing, just, you know, you mentioned the tetanus shot, and if I remember correctly, there is a recommendation that you get booster TB vaccines, I think, every decade or so.
That's right.
So that is the other really open question, which is how long will this vaccine last? Is it a one and done? I mean, actually, the Moderna vaccine is two shots taken a month apart. But after that, are you done for life? Does that provide you immunity or whatever protection, however efficacious it is, for the rest of your life? Or will there be a need for some sort of booster shot like the tetanus shot? And the answer to that is we don't know, and we won't know, because that answer can only happen basically in real time. So
yeah,
even beyond the phase three trials, participants will continue to be tracked. They call this in like post-marketing studies, where, you know, things like the level of antibodies in their blood and other things will continue to be tracked on potentially for years, because we want to know the answer to that, the durability of these vaccines. But you can't know that just by running a phase three trial.
So last question, if someone is listening who would like to be in a vaccine trial, do they take volunteers?
Yeah, so to enroll in a study, I think a lot of this information can either be found, I think, potentially on a company website or on, I think, typically a company website, or they get recruited via trial sites. And the question is mostly going to be depending on where you are located, because the way a phase three trial runs is basically around half of about 30,000 people. That's been roughly the size of them. Half of them get the real vaccine, half of them get a placebo, and then they run the trial until a certain number of infections get hit or a certain number of people get sick, and then they look back and they say, how many of those people had the vaccine? How many of those people got the placebo? And hopefully the answer is most of them or all of them had the placebo. And so in order to run that study, it means you have to be in a place where infections are happening. So if you think about it, if we ran this trial in a place where the infection rate was really, really, really low, it would take forever to run that trial. So for that reason, manufacturers are trying to pick their trial sites in places where there are ongoing infections. So I think that's probably the biggest criteria. But if you go on the clinicaltrials.gov, that's where you can see information about the ongoing trials, and they also list trial sites there, and you can find out more information that way.
So if you want to be in a vaccine trial, move to Texas, it sounds like. We leave it there with Caroline Chen, health reporter for ProPublica. So informative, Caroline. Thank you so, so much.
Thanks for having me.